From WGCU News, this is Gulf Coast Live. In celebration of Hispanic Heritage Month, WGCU Public Media and the Hispanic Institute at Hodges University recently hosted a preview of Latino Americans, the first major documentary series for television chronicling the lives and experiences of Latinos in the United States from 1500 to the 21st century. It airs on WGCU-TV on September 24th and October 1st. Southwest Floridians who got an early glimpse of the series share their personal stories of being a Latino in the area with us today.
We all know that we have something in common, even though our backgrounds could be very, very different.
Area Latinos share their thoughts on their culture, politics, voting, immigration, and language. First, this news. From WGCU News, this is Gulf Coast Live. I'm Ashley Lopez. Thanks for joining us. In celebration of Hispanic Heritage Month and the debut of Latino Americans, a new six-part PBS series about the history of Latinos in America, WGCU and the Hispanic Institute at Hodges University hosted a discussion among Southwest Florida Latinos recently. Today, we bring you that previously recorded discussion that includes what it's like to be Latino American in this region, politics, immigration, assimilation, and even food.
This is David Plaza. He's the engagement editor for the News Press here in Fort Myers. He was born in Chicago. His father is Colombian and his mother is Cuban, just like mine. Plaza's received his bachelor's degree and two master's degrees here in the States at Northwestern University and Florida Gulf Coast University. And he studied and worked abroad in Spain, Costa Rica, and Mexico. Plazas has been very involved in the National Association of Hispanic Journalists and founded a short-lived local chapter here in 2005, and he's lived here since the year 2000. Moving this way, this is Joe Pacheco. He was born to Puerto Rican immigrants and was raised in New York City, a New Yorker. Pacheco spent 37 years as an educator, becoming a New York City school district superintendent, and was very active in Latino educational advocacy causes, and as the president of the Puerto Rican Educators and the co-chairman of COPRES, which is a coalition of Black and Puerto Rican educators. And Pacheco retired here in Sanibel in 1996 and became president of the Southwest Hispanic Chamber of Commerce in 1999 to 2000, and he served on Governor Jeb Bush's One Florida Accountability Commissioner. He's also a member of the WGCU Public Media Advisory Board. He has retired from active advocacy to write poetry and has published three books, the most recent Sanibel Joe's Songbook. And lastly, we have Maria Palacio. She is the Senior Librarian and Outreach Services Manager for the Lee County Library Services System. And she's of Colombian heritage and was born and raised in New Jersey. Her family moved to Florida in 1999 and lived in Miami first before moving to Southwest Florida in 2000. In 2011, she won the Lyricist Next Gen Librarian Award, which is a really big award, and was invited by the U.S. Embassy in Madrid to speak at a multi-city library conference. She not only represented this region, but also this country, and shared the library's experiences in making its resources more accessible to immigrants. And she's a graduate of Florida State University. All right, so we'll start with the first question. You know, how has the status and the roles of the Latino population changed in your time here and in this region compared to when you first came here, if there's been a difference at all? So we'll start with you, David.
Sure. I arrived here in 2000, and at the time, the census numbers for Lee County said there were about 42,000 Latinos. You can imagine that 13 years later, there are almost 120,000. It's just been a remarkable growth. If you look at other counties, there's been tremendous growth as well. Collier County, Glades, Hendry. In the mid part of that decade, of the last decade, I was the editor of La Gaceta Tropical, which was the first weekly Spanish language publication, and I had to monitor these numbers every single week. I saw anecdotally that there were these growing communities. And we had known that we had had an agricultural labor force here for some time, but the growth really started happening in the professional, middle class, and urban sector of the Latino community. And that was amazing to see that growth, but there was also a lot of tension during that time, too. And I still remember being at a meeting in Cape Coral where a city councilwoman emphatically told a group of Hispanic presenters that everyone here should just speak English and let it be. You know, if they don't want to be here, then go, essentially. So it was that culture shock that you saw in the preview was happening here because of the boom in population.
Okay, Joe.
When I came to Southwest Florida, I knew that when I walked among the Latinos here, I might be considered a New York carpetbagger, a New Yorican carpetbagger. And I did feel that we were about 25 or 30 years behind New York City in terms of being involved in politics and economically and of being treated fairly and equally. And so although I had retired, I became active in the chamber and helped straighten the chamber out until it's become much better now, a full-time organization. But what struck me most was that in several instances I had to relive the same experiences I had to relive, I lived through in my childhood. You speak English? Oh, Puerto Rico, where is that? Why can't they learn to speak English? And I was hearing it all over again. I thought that in New York we had finally put to rest, but I saw these same biases here. And I had to relive them. And why do you need a separate Hispanic chamber, a chamber for Hispanics, et cetera, et cetera? And it's still going on.
I'll say that, when I moved to Southwest Florida, I started teaching high school at a local high school here in Lee County. And it was sort of different, definitely a culture shock coming from New Jersey and then coming from Miami, which I thought we were pretty diverse up in New Jersey, but it's completely different in Miami. And it was great. But when I was hired in 2003 for the library, my position as multicultural program coordinator, I was the second person to fill that position. And it was created to bring Latinos or Latin Americans and Haitians into the library to physically go out and bring them, because it was just created in response to the growing numbers of these immigrants into this area, and we wanted them to come in and use the library. So it was a new sort of job for me. Luckily, I had made contacts, but I think that things changed, and actually the position evolved to not only just bring them into the library, but then can you help us pick out some books that they might be interested in? We already had a Spanish language collection in the library, but can you help us sort of, you know, what else can you recommend? And we've have some good people there that are still doing a great job finding materials that will be of interest to these two groups. But it's ongoing, and the position has evolved from just getting people to come into the library to offering more services, whether it's something that's electronic on our website. Can we offer this in native language? And if we're going to write this policy in English or this new procedure in English, then we should have this information out in Spanish. And just all kinds of different things that we've done to target and in response to the changes here.
And I'll open the next question up to whoever, you know, has anything to say about this. But something that really stands out to me is the lack of political representation here for Latinos in Southwest Florida. I mean, in Miami, it's almost like, you know, all Latino neighborhoods have, you know, a state rep, a state house, a senator now, you know, U.S. senator, and, you know, congressional members that represent their areas. Why do you think this is, and why do you think this is where do you think this stems from?
Sure. In the last, and I believe I'm correct, but in the last 20 years or so, there have been two elected officials who are Latino in at least the Lee County, the Southwest Florida area. Sadly, their careers ended very badly. One of them was a former county commissioner who spent some time in jail afterwards, and one of them was a Cape Coral city councilman who was suspended from office by the governor. So this has been created perhaps this image among some people, and I know I've spoken to a lot of people over the last couple of years who use that as an example as why Latinos haven't been elected. But I think the real reason, though, is the lack of organization, because this is a relatively young community when it comes to organizing politically. And again, you know, a lot of the roots, especially in the 70s, were more agricultural, so that middle class, those middle class roots are relatively new. In the last 15 years or so, you've had the Southwest Florida Hispanic Chamber of Commerce, the Hispanic American Citizens Council. You've had all sorts of different other Latino groups that have advocated for civic change, the Nations Association, the many others that have basically put at the forefront the need to vote, and that historically the Latino vote has been very, very low. And so even though we've seen trends grow nationally, we haven't seen the same level of growth here in Southwest Florida. Part of it may be a citizenship issue. Part of it may be as well just a lack of education issue. And that's one thing that I know a lot of groups are really trying to seed, plant those seeds to really develop a crop of people who could be elected to office.
6 years ago, I wrote a speech called Corriendo Detrás del Voto, or Chasing the Vote, urging the Latinos with Reverend Suarez, urging the Latinos to register and to vote. Unfortunately, the Latino vote did not increase substantially after that speech. Not that there were that many people listening to it. But my point is that we're powerless if we don't vote. And what happened in the last presidential election is that the Latino vote finally came out and had an impact. And the fact that the Republicans had totally alienated the Latino communities in the United States forced or encouraged Latinos to come out to vote and vote Democratic. And that was the negative reason, perhaps. What happened here is the Latinos don't vote because they just don't see the value. They don't see any elected Latino officials, and it's almost like a vicious circle. They don't see any Latinos, you know, running the county, so they don't think that their vote is important. But I do think that from now on, the Latino vote will start to increase and be important here in Lee and Collier.
I agree with what Joe was saying, and I think that that probably two there's two problems. Probably one is there is a lack of unity. I believe with our Latino community, probably nationwide, but definitely locally, that maybe is hindering the sort of the progress we're making politically and as far as representation. It is a shame when you elect someone and it's very disappointing. You're sort of proud that, yeah, we have representation, and then they really sort of don't do the right thing. And so then, of course, it's hard for people to trust that person, right? I also think that but at the same time, I still think that things are evolving the way Joe says with the new with our president and as well as just people that are coming out. But the third thing I wanted to say really is and maybe this is true of more recent immigrants that coming from in their countries, voting may not count because there's all kinds of problems in a lot of countries and maybe that their view is that the more things change, the more they stay the same. So maybe what is the point in voting? But we really want to teach people here that it does count. And so we just need to keep telling people, I think.
I just wanted to add, too, that we've had many qualified candidates run for office. You know, my good friend Riel Fernandez, who's here with us, and, you know, we've had many others who have come who've just been tremendous candidates. Within the state, it's interesting because the first Latino state senator was elected last year, Darren Soto, and he's from the Orlando area, and it was a coalition of Puerto Rican and Cuban voters that very much helped him get elected to office. We don't have that same kind of political pull in Southwest Florida. However, if one looks at the Marco Rubio example, here's a Cuban senator. He was a Speaker of the House for the Florida Legislature, and he won with majority the votes with the majority of Caucasian votes, and he had some Latino backing as well from his roots in Miami.
We're speaking with News Press Engagement Editor David Plazas, Sanibel poet Joe Pacheco, and librarian Maria Palacio about being Latino in Southwest Florida today on Gulf Coast Live. This panel was previously recorded at the Hispanic Institute at Hodges University. And, you know, I noticed that all of us have, and all of you guys especially, have lived in big cities, which are either more diverse or just have bigger Latino populations because they're just bigger cities. How does it compare living in, I guess, a smaller city like, you know, Fort Myers or Cape Coral, you know, to having, you know, the mass metropolis of diversity of a big city? How do your experiences compare?
Well, I come from a place where 85% of the voters vote Democratic. I was the president of a political club where if you won the Democratic primary, just like here with the Republicans, where everybody was a Democrat. And when I came down here, for the first time in my life, there was a Republican majority and a sizable Republican majority. And I really had difficulty in adjusting. And with that came also the fact that that I was considered a liberal and a left wing, and everybody else who I was, you know, associating with on Sanibel, they were all Republicans and didn't understand many of the things that I believed in.
Yeah, I'll say that it's definitely strange. Same thing coming from New Jersey. Lifelong Democrats. Everyone is a Democrat except when you come here, and so it was definitely a little bit different. But I remember that even when I was a teacher talking to another teacher, they were sort of surprised and were only 2 hours away from Miami, and they didn't realize that Latinos in Miami generally voted Republican, and they were just so surprised by that. That's how little they knew. And I mean, this was the early 2000s.
If anything, I mean, some of the things that we started to see, as I mentioned before, was the tensions because of the population growth, and especially in the school system. You know, when I came here in 2000, I think the Latino population was just a small fraction, and then slowly it started to grow. By the time I was editor of the Spanish Language Weekly, it was at about 25 or 30%. So it kept on growing year over year over year. So a lot of it, seeing what had happened in Chicago, where I was from, you know, many, many years ago, and having read about that, this is the stuff that happened in the 70s, and it was happening here. But a lot of it has to do with demographic growth. You have a very transient community here, a very mobile community here in Southwest Florida, and naturally there have been a lot of tensions. Many of us were here in this very room for a special project called Agenda Hispana, the Hispanic Agenda, to talk about what are those things that are affecting the community the most. And what we found is that we focused on 4 different topics that we could handle locally. They revolved around education, healthcare, they revolved around housing, and then also public safety, because there were a lot of public safety issues that we're experiencing, from Latinos who weren't reporting crimes to the police, maybe because they were undocumented immigrants, or maybe because in their own countries they would never get help from authorities. And so we were seeing a lot of things that I had not been used to seeing. So it was a completely different – it was a culture shock, really.
And, you know, there's a lot of talk about what it means to be Latino or Latina. You know, it seems like everyone has a different definition. You know, there's, you know, people who live in Portuguese, for example, would not probably call themselves Latino, although, you know, someone might think like you are from either Spain, Portugal, South America, Central America, therefore you are Latino. I wonder what is Latino to you? How do you identify that to mean for yourself?
Well, you know you're Latino when you meet another Latino and you just know it. And he could be from Colombia, Argentina, Mexico, Uruguay, from Cuba. But we all know that we have something in common, even though our backgrounds could be very, very different. But we're aware as Latinos of the differences among us. The difference between a Mexican and a Cuban and a Colombiano. But we always remember, and that's what I used to tell members of the chamber, remember that the non-Latinos all see us as one, as if we all came from one country where they don't speak English.
Yeah, I think, you know, the identity, I sometimes jokingly said years ago that I was a gringo Latino because I was born and raised in this country. I'm English, Tom, and I do speak Spanish. I've worked in Latin America. But the reality is culturally, half Cuban, half Colombian, it was a whole crazy mix of sorts. And so it was really trying to find that identity. What am I? Where am I from? And you realize that there is a broad Latino community, but I think what I see, especially in a lot of younger people that I've worked with, especially students, is that the notion to segregate oneself is less and less desirable. There's really a sense of wanting to join the overall community through social media means, for example, whether it's Facebook or Twitter or some other means, people want to connect with each other. But the Latino identity, I think, is important because it gives us that connection to our roots and our heritage. We were talking at an event earlier today about Cuban food, like ropa vieja, and which is shredded beef, essentially, which is delicious, and rice and beans and all these things that connect us to our culture and our family and our heritage. And I think that's what makes us who we are, is those histories, those oral histories, and it's just a reminder of the people who helped raise us.
Well, being Latina to me means being unique in certain places, different in a lot of settings just about every day. But I'm proud of it. I'm proud of my heritage. And at the same time, I'm proud to be an American. And I teach my kids, even though I named my younger son Andres, that he is as American as anyone else. And so it's just fun, a unique sort of experience, some color, some salsa, whatever, if you will, just something different to add. So.
And so anti-immigrant prejudice or, you know, nativism has been a reality in this country for a pretty long time. But, I guess the last several years, a lot of that has been almost squarely directed at the Latino population. I wonder what you think, if there's been any progress in that. I mean, this year there's been polling on whether immigration has public support, and there has been a lot of support shown. Do you think the tide is turning? Do you think that... Great Recession era Latino prejudice is sort of tapering off as more people sort of embrace the idea of immigration reform? Or do you think we're kind of in the same place? And anyone can take that question.
Sure. I mean, historically, we've seen waves of anti-immigrant sentiment, you know, whether it was in the late 19th century, early 20th century with European immigrants. And in 2006, you know, just as recent as that, there were large marches around the country, including one with 80,000 people here in Fort Myers who were saying, we don't want a law that will criminalize being an undocumented immigrant. And it was amazing. It was a very peaceful march as well. And so I think the tide has turned due to politics and demography. You know, it is not politically correct anymore to be anti-immigrant. I mean, there still are those factions, and there still are people who will vote for that, but it's become much more appealing as if you want to be elected again to be more pro-immigrant. The question is, how do we get there, and what kind of, is it called amnesty? Is it called, some sort of a citizenship with consequences? Those kinds of things are the things that are going to be debated, but it's definitely changed even in the last 7 years.
But most of us are not undocumented immigrants. And those people that voted in the last election were all American citizens. And Latinos, they were voting partly out of sympathy with their brothers from their, you know, with their Latino brothers who haven't become citizens, perhaps. But the issue of immigration is not as important to Latinos as some people make it out to be, because we're talking about all the other things that affect Americans, education and jobs, and that's what we're interested in most and that we have to do something about. So Latino is just not immigration. Most of us are Americans. And we're concerned about immigrants, helping immigrants, but we're not immigrants. We're Americans, and we vote, and we will vote for justice for all people when we get it in the next election.
Well, I think Joe said it all. I don't think I could say anything that could top what he says, and we're not here to compete with each other. But definitely, the issue of immigration is important. But as Joe says, I do agree in a sense. When my family came here 50 years ago, it was much easier to come here. They really did not have those struggles that our brothers and sisters have here today, and they certainly weren't invisible in that way. And of course, I sympathize with them. And but the truth is, at least in my own view, that it's probably not the number one issue right now for all Latinos, because as Joe said, we are American. But it's definitely something that is important, and hopefully with the election of Senator Rubio and a lot of non-Latinos voted for him, and I wondered if they even knew that he was Latino. But as I saw his sign all over my neighborhood, but hopefully things will change. And I think that if people do have this anti-immigrant sentiment, these kinds of views, because it's just really not politically correct, I really don't see a lot of it coming out. Maybe they just sort of talk about it at home or something, but certainly not in our faces, I think.
Yeah, one thing I do have to point out, that because we talked about Democratic and Republican politics, it was a Republican Senator McCain who's been really the champion for immigration reform all these years. And so I think to look at it historically, and even the recent Gang of Eight, it was half Republican, half Democrat. And so I think, you know, people who are really thinking about the demographics, the politics, are knowing, let's think about the future. And it's going to be important not to demonize people, because we see that, you know, especially in Miami area, Republicans, Cubans are generally Republican. All the elected officials who are Cuban are Republican. And the politics is changing from the times of the 60s and 70s, where it was very anti-Castro. And not to say that it isn't, but that certainly it's become less externally focused, and I think more internally focused, as we saw with the 2008 and 2012 elections.
Yeah, and I want to talk about something that is a big part of an immigrant's life and their children as well, and that's assimilation. I mean, how do you feel about, you know, Latino culture, the culture of your parents, either getting changed as it sort of merges with your experiences as an American, or, you know, in some ways getting lost as the generations go by? What are your feelings about that?
I'm just glad that my parents never spoke to me in English, because my problem was language loss, losing Spanish. I didn't speak English. I was born here, and I didn't speak English till about the age of three, with my brother. And I went out to play. I didn't speak English, and they hadn't cut my hair either. I had long curls, and my playmates pulled my hair and said "ding dong bell," and I realized that I had to learn English. But by the age of four and a half, I was already speaking Spanglish, you know, and my Spanish, I had moved already from Spanish dominant to English dominant, as do most of the children here who have mothers who speak Spanish at home. But because everybody in my family spoke Spanish at home, I never lost Spanish. And then as I went to school, I studied Spanish and eventually became, one of my teaching licenses was day high school teacher of Spanish. And I became very proficient and literate in Spanish, recovering the dominance that I had lost as a child. But thank God that some parents don't cave in and continue keeping Spanish for their children. It's a wonderful thing to have, and it's a wonderful thing to be bilingual.
You know, I think we know of communities that have had to assimilate, maybe because of cultural pressures. Maybe parents have come here to say that, you know, or maybe schools themselves, you know, there's literature that shows that people stop speaking Spanish at all. I feel that my upbringing was richer because I had that Spanish language, food, and culture within my, you know, both the Cuban side and Colombian side. Being able to visit Colombia, I've never been to Cuba, but being able to visit Colombia and meet with relatives and have that amazing experience that helped make me who I am today. I think that if anything, when it comes to assimilation, we're going to see a much more multicultural type of society. For example, I have two nieces who, my brother is Colombian and Cuban, my sister-in-law is Ecuadorian, and they're, one of them was born in Italy because he's in the military, so it's this whole mix of cultures. And on the other side, one is Caucasian from Chicago, and then a good, and it's all these wonderful cultures that come in together and that really support each other. But even my gringo brother-in-law has learned Spanish and speaks to his children in Spanish as well.
Yeah, I would say that we really haven't, because assimilation, in my view, is more forgetting our traditions and just, say, doing away with native language. So I can't say that I've assimilated in my own home. My children are not fluent in Spanish, unfortunately. They do understand a lot of it and can speak some. But, I mean, an example of sort of their American-ness and their Latino roots, this week my son said, we're having a fiesta in Spanish class, and so you're going to bring arepas. And that's something that I ended up doing something different. But that's what he equates with what his heritage is. And I can't, again, having roots in Miami, because I only lived there a short time, but my family's lived there for a long, long time, and our families from all over the place. My cousins are all Colombian American, and there's Greek, and there's even Cuban. There's non-Latinos, white Americans, I guess, if you will. And so, and it's excellent. We'll go from cumbia to a Greek song, and everyone will get up and dance. So,
yeah. But unlike Miami, you know, it might be more of a necessity to give up the language a little more, or in some ways, you know, you make English your primary language in order to work, you know, and feed your kids, that sort of thing. So do you feel like in a region like Southwest Florida compared to maybe New Jersey or Miami, do you feel like the need to assimilate is a little greater here?
Well, let me just say that in the year 2000, I think when I was president of the Hispanic Chamber here, that the chamber in Miami issued a study that they had commissioned, and they found that only 2% of the Cuban-American students graduating from the Miami high schools could conduct business or a literate conversation in Spanish. They could manage el idioma del hogar, you know, and speak the abuelita, but they certainly couldn't run a business or enact the deal or serve on customers in Spanish. And so that language loss is the problem that all immigrants encounter. Their children end up becoming English dominant. So the fear that everyone has that if you have a bilingual education program, the kids won't learn English is not really founded on any kind of reality. But rather, and when I first came here, I tried to talk the schools into it. I didn't really make much progress. They should try to develop the non-English language ability through bilingual education programs and not teach the kids English, to abandon Spanish as quickly as possible so they could be mainstreamed in the school system.
There's been an interesting development over the years in terms of the embrace of Spanish, because there was a lot of tension on the school board. I used to cover the school board years ago, and you know, even thinking about offering Spanish in the elementary schools was scary to some school board members. But imagine today in 2013, Tice Elementary School in the east part of Fort Myers has a dual language program. It's amazing. You know, from first through fifth grade or K through fifth grade, you're learning both English and Spanish. And not just if you're Latino, but if you're of any culture, so you are able to be set up to be successful in two languages, which is going to make you, if you speak them well and communicate well, going to give you an advantage, as many studies show as well.
And to add to that, David, Tice Elementary is, from what I understand, having a great program in bilingual education, and there's at least two private schools that I know of here in Lee County who teach Spanish. At least one school in Cape Coral has Spanish class from pre-K 3, I believe, or 4, and so they're getting that even if it's once a week at first and then twice a week afterwards, they obviously realize the importance of being able to speak or communicate in some way in two languages.
They're catching up to where we were in New York City 25 years ago.
And it's important to mention that we're at Hodges University, which has the area's first ever Hispanic Institute. And that's a huge, huge milestone. I think it's been around 5 years, and a lot of the model came from a Massachusetts institute, but it's something that's spectacular. You know, imagine that, a place where you advocate for engagement, where you advocate for research, and you really become a catalyst for conversation. I mean, that's something that wouldn't have been imagined about 10, 15 years ago. So I don't think there's the pressures to assimilate like there was before. Rather, there's a lot more celebration and a lot more embrace of the fact that this world is much bigger, and especially with the online community, it's much, much bigger than you ever imagined, and commerce isn't only done in English. And by Latinos, it's also done in English.
Yeah. We're speaking with News Press Engagement Editor David Plazas, Sanibel poet Joe Pacheco, and librarian Maria Palacio about being Latino in Southwest Florida today on Gulf Coast Live. This panel was previously recorded at the Hispanic Institute at Hodges University.
And that's a nice segue into one of my last questions, which is about where you think the Latino community is now. I mean, there is some activism. The Immokalee farm workers, for example, have done an amazing job in getting some goals across and really moving the status of farm workers here forward. But there's been a Latino Chamber of Commerce and academia. You know, the library. I mean, There have been strides, but do you think there's more work to be done in terms of political, economic power? Where do you think the Latino population is now in terms of that, the status of that?
Well, we're a Republican county, by far the majority. The Republicans have a big majority here. But I haven't seen any overtures from them, really, toward the Latino community. Until we mobilize the Latino vote, and it has a significant impact on an election here on a local level, we're going to be ignored. And we won't be having Latino commissioners or Latino board members. So I haven't seen what I'd like to say. Well, we're coming a long, long way. Not here in Lee County or Collier.
I think a lot of the seeding of this comes from grassroots efforts to, not just expect someone to lend a hand out, but really insert yourself into a process. And I think ultimately we'll see more people as they get politically motivated, either join the Republican Party or join whatever group it is. To give you an example, in the 2012 elections, the Hispanic American Citizens Council held a political forum that had 500 people with local elected officials and local residents, and that was huge. You know, most political forums have a handful of people going to them, and this was something remarkable in this era. So I think the seeds are being planted. When I talk to elected officials, Latinos are part of their conversation today, and it's because of the people that include Carmen Ray Gomez at the Institute, or many of these people, Joe and Maria, and many others who are essentially asking questions. Today I was at an event where local journalist Jackie Figueroa got the key to the city from Mayor Henderson, the first Latina to do that. So I don't think that Latinos are being ignored. I think right now the seeds have been planted, and it's part of the conversation within elected officials that they can't ignore Latinos.
And I think that Latinos should definitely, I see young people here. I think that we can't just live, and I didn't learn this really until I moved to this state, that I can't just live in a place, that I have to be a part of it, that I have to know what's going on. And in my own way, I can affect change, perhaps professionally and hopefully and broaden sort of what we're doing so that the young people can see what we're doing and maybe follow our example. I think it's great what a lot of people are doing, as David mentioned, but I don't think it should be just a handful of people working on behalf of the Latino community. I think that more people need to get involved, and I not to preach to people, but I do think education is important in Latinos. I am probably one of just a few people in my place of employment that is bilingual. And if I'm not in the office and we get a phone call, well, what do we do? So I think that it's part of people probably need to become more educated in English. We live here. We need to be a part of that. And at the same time, people who work in these settings should look at these kinds of careers and sort of just strive to just do a little more, not just live in the present, is what I would say.
All right. My last question, you know, ultimately to be Latino in America means you are straddling two cultures. You're almost inhabiting like two different worlds, and that gets kind of complicated. And I mean, is this something, a constant struggle after? I mean, I'm guessing now things, you know, you've gotten a hang of it, but, you know, growing up and, you know, being in this region for the first time, is that something that was something you embraced, resented, or is it a struggle between the two?
Well, I wrote a short poem that was a title poem of my first poetry book, the first in the New Yorkers, and the last line that summarizes the Latino bicultural experience, to be alone in two worlds at the same time. Because at the same time, you don't speak Spanish. Many of us speak Spanish with a gringo accent, or we use a great many Spanglish words, American words, right into the Spanish. And also in the Anglo world, they look upon us as a Latino, and the Latino world often looks upon us as an Anglo or as a gringo.
I agree with Joe, with what Joe is saying, I always feel like I'm straddling two cultures. I even wrote that to Ashley, and even like, you know, Thanksgiving, I want to have an all-American Thanksgiving, and we're not serving rice, you know, but it's something that I do feel that sort of loneliness that Joe alluded to, because I'm not, I mean, I am Latina, but I'm also American. I read a lot in English, and I keep reading in Spanish because it's becoming, it's really important, and lately has been extremely important in my work. So, that's really all I can say about that right now.
How could you not serve rice?
Because we have it all the time.
Yeah, I just wanted to affirm many of Joe's experiences, but because he's a part of my parents' generation, and I say that with tremendous respect, because the sacrifices that they made it possible for me to not face the discrimination that they had to face when they first came here. My father was a psychologist, and when he came to Chicago at the time in the 70s, a lot of children who only spoke Spanish were classified as mentally retarded because of that, because it was thought that they couldn't learn English, and that wasn't the case. So there was a whole cultural shift that you had to make, and there were some things coming to this community that I said, wow, a lot of these stories, and I don't want to paint a broad brush because it's not like that, but a lot of those things were a reminder of those kinds of experiences. So I affirm what Joe felt when he came here and said, this is what I felt so many years ago. In many cases, this is what I remember hearing my parents go through when I came to this community. Being born here, being a citizen, speaking English, it's a huge advantage, no doubt. And when I've covered or met people who don't have those same advantages, they really are at a great disadvantage in this community.
Well, thank you very much, Maria, Joe, David. Thank you for joining us. Now I'm going to just open it up to you guys. If you have a question, the mic's right there. Go ahead. Question.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you for the opportunity to allow me to ask this question. My name is Marta, and just moved to Southwest Florida 5 months ago. I'm originally from Mexico City, and I've been in this country for 30 years. Lived 30 years in 32, because I lived 2 years in Colorado and 30 in Atlanta. And 30 years ago when I moved to Atlanta, Atlanta was the way you are describing Fort Myers today, Cape Coral. And I appreciate your comments and I appreciate the research, but it frightens me. I come from a place where the economic burden is held by the Latinos. The cash power, when these people walk into, can I say a company name? Oh, no. Well, a grocery store that is famous around the world, starts with a W, and it would close the doors if my people wouldn't shop there. And I don't see any problem with having the prices in English and in Spanish. Like you, I was benefited. I came to this country educated. I was a teacher. I wrote and read English, Spanish, and French. It was fortunate. But I will definitely, and I have dual citizenship. I'm really privileged. But I am not a party target. I have the quality and the dignities that God has given me. And I trust that you guys that have the mic are not you know, overpassing how old I am or what, you know, what I've done before. It's what I have today and what the minimum dignity of my life should stand for. And I spent many time since I've been here in Immokalee. It just happened to be one of the places that I go to. You will think I'll be in Sanibel on the beach. Sometimes I do. And I love it. And I'm extremely grateful. And I pray that I can bloom where I'm planted. And I'm going to offer any support I can do. I own a bilingual preschool in Atlanta. And it's been very successful. But my point is, my mouth is for the people in Immokalee. Great, they organize, but they still live in unprivileged, undignifying conditions. So, hooray, we're going to vote, we may have a party. No, everybody has to be equal. And I really appreciate it. And one thing, when I call, because I'm looking, of course, for living places, when I leave a message, my accent happens that nobody returns my call. So I know I'm judged over the phone. But if my husband calls, we get the phone call returned right away. So I'm like, oh. But I don't take it personal. I seriously don't. And I'm going to be completely hands-on in this beautiful place. It's amazing. So thank you. Oh, my question. What are we doing to bring the dignity of life in all areas? And Dream Act. Dream Act shouldn't be hidden under the table in this city. That's it.
Let me just respond by saying that in 2000 AD, I was president of the Hispanic Chamber, and there was a protest was being made by the Immokalee workers. They were going to picket Taco Bell, and I wanted the chamber, the members of the chamber, to support it and come and join them on the picket line. And the members of my chamber said no. They didn't want to be involved in that. And that if I went, I could not speak for the chamber. That if I went, I could only speak for myself. So I went in front of Taco Bell and picketed with the Immokalee Coalition. And naturally, the reporters recognized me because we are still a small town in many ways. They immediately came up to me and asked me, if the chamber was supporting the workers. I said, no, I'm not here on behalf of the chamber. I'm here as a Latino individual to support my Latino brothers and sisters in their quest for a more decent life and higher wages. But 6 years later, the members of that chamber, a lot of them, including Leonardo Garcia, who was the executive director then, and I marched with 70,000 other Latinos in the famous march that we had here. So we have made progress, and it will get better.
And to add to what Joe said, and also an answer to your question about what we're doing, the library as a and I'm here as myself, but I can't not talk about my work. It's part of what I do. It's information. So one thing that we have done the last few years is offer naturalization information sessions, and we have people come from the Tampa field office, and it started first with people from the Miami office coming to the library to help to answer questions. So every time there's something new, whether it's the temporary protected status and now with DACA, am I saying it correctly, and just with citizenship in general, we've been having all kinds of sessions in different libraries. Wherever we think there'll be an audience, we're trying to offer that in collaboration with the Office of Citizenship and Immigration. And at the end of March, we actually held our first naturalization ceremony in a library here in Lee County. And there were people from 20 different countries represented, and about 50 people became American citizens that day.
Yeah, as a journalist, I'm a storyteller. And over the years, I've had the opportunity to tell many stories. And our role is to tell them without prejudice and also elevating the dignity of them as human beings. And those have included really hard stories, like a story of Chilean immigrants who came here, overstayed their tourist visa just so they could raise some money to help their child get a foot operation because he had club foot. And that media coverage helped, you know, the Shriners helped this boy, you know, because of that. I've also seen some of the negative things, such as the fact that in Immokalee, it has a very high HIV infection rate, and especially among people who are over the age of 45. The average age is about 27 in the state of Florida. And so there's a lot where migrant workers, for example, have for whatever reason, not protected themselves during sexual relations, and that has caused a situation that I reported way back. But it was about not telling a shame, but rather telling the story of human beings that are living with HIV or AIDS and what it means to their ability to make money for their family, for example. So I think that telling those stories without fear of retribution is what our role as journalists has to be.
We're speaking with News Press Engagement Editor David Plazas, Sanibel poet Joe Pacheco, and librarian Maria Palacio about being Latino in Southwest Florida today on Gulf Coast Live. This panel was previously recorded at the Hispanic Institute at Hodges University.
My name is Art Merriman, and I'm a resident of Cape Coral. I'm struck by the void of reference to religious organizations and their contributions to the Hispanic community at large. I can personally say during my last 30 years of being the honored spouse of a Mexican woman that my own personal integration into the Hispanic community has been greatly enhanced by those organizations. And I'd like to know what you think about the role of organized religion in this effort.
Sure. You know, the churches and religious groups have been extremely important. You know, whether you have, for example, Jesus the Worker Church, which is a Catholic church, in the Eastern Fort Myers community, or whether you have the growth of the evangelical churches, for example, around town, they have really been critical. The Amigos Center, which is a Lutheran-based organization that has become a champion for immigrants, immigration reform, and also helping people get status and claim here. So, yeah, so they've been absolutely fundamental to being part of the Latino experience.
The Diocese of Venice, Catholic Charities, offers all kinds of services to Latinos in this area. And you know, at first they sort of targeted Latinos, and now if you visit there, there's people from all over coming in because they know that they can get assistance there. And then David mentioned Jesus the Worker Church. One of the priests that was there is now at St. Andrew Catholic Church, and for years St. Andrew Catholic Church has offered a mass at 1:15 in Spanish on Sunday, and there's a church on Pine Island that offers mass in Spanish. And you know, we found, too, in our work in libraries, working with some communities, that people will trust what is said from their religious leader. So if we can't get them to come into the library, so maybe we should go to their church or whatever their faith tradition is. And so I went to a mass once in Brazilian Portuguese, and I've been to a Haitian church. So it's a neat experience, but that's where people like that, in that sense, that's where they trust the information that comes from there. And so we definitely have to work with those organizations, and they're doing a lot.
Very often the only institutional resource for illegal immigrants is the Catholic Church and some of the evangelical churches.
My name is Araceli Gomez. I'm a social worker. I moved from Mexico in 1995, and you are definitely an Orgullo Latino, and I follow most of you. And obviously, I'm very proud of our women shaker, Carmen, to make us be in the map. I do live in Collier County, and my reality is a little different than yours. And there's just a couple comments. You were mentioning the word assimilation, and I think one of the hardest things for the new immigrant to assimilate is because we don't look, we're not white. We can, what would be the word? We can
pass.
Merge. We can
pass.
Yeah, it's going to be very easy for you to identify that I'm not white, right? So I do have to embrace my identity because that's the only way I can survive. And what was happening in Collier, for example, is one of the high schools there, we have a 40% of dropout rates among Hispanics and Blacks. And one of the problems that we see, it's hard for them to identify with leaders that look like them. So something that research shows is that when people integrate, the new immigrant integrate, they improve their mental health, they improve their activism, they improve their relationships with families. So when we're asking immigrants to assimilate, what we're doing is they're leaving their roots behind, and we're creating separation among parents and children. And I don't think we want that as a society. So I'm a strong promoter of biculturalism and integration. The other thing is we definitely need help in Collier County. I mean, 26% of the population are from Hispanic descendant, and out of that 26%, over 50% are from Mexican descendant. So, you know, our dynamics are a little different. You were saying people need to be more active politically, but for them to feel empowered to do that, they need to have this sense of belonging. And when you live in a hostile environment, it's very difficult to have that connection with other for people. So I do believe the environment has a big role to do in all of us, you know. Have. Last thing I want to mention is the trouble with unity is when you are saying the immigration is not as important to you, I do have a difference with you because immigration is extremely important to me. My neighbors, my family members are dealing with immigration issues. So that's why it's difficult to be represented by Puerto Rican, by Colombian, by Cuban. I don't agree with Mr. Marco Rubio because he doesn't speak the way I can relate to him. So I do understand that one of the solutions is each of us have to become a leaders. And for us to happen, we have to create an environment where people feel empowered. I just encourage you to go to Collier and do the same thing. And I'm more than happy to assist with that. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much, everyone, for your questions. I think that completes the panel portion. Thank you so much to our panelists. Thank you very much.
That was News Press Engagement Editor David Plazas, Sanibel poet Joe Pacheco, and librarian Maria Palacio speaking as part of a panel about being Latino in Southwest Florida, previously recorded at the Hispanic Institute at Hodges University. PBS documentary series Latino Americans airs on WGCU-TV September 24th and October 1st. Information is at wgcu.org/Gulf Coast Live. Comment on Facebook at WGCU Public Media or send an email to gulfcoastlive@wgcu.org. Thanks to Barbara Steinoff, Barbara Lindstrom, Carmen Ray Gomez, and Luke Martin. I'm Ashley Lopez. This is WGCU Fort Myers, 90.1 FM, WMKO Marco, 91.7 FM, NPR for Southwest Florida.